Senate Committee on State and Federal Affairs, February 28, 1967. Agenda, Senate Bill 19. Creates the office of...
Discussion of the now new draft of partial responsibility. Is it the intended chair to go ahead like that? I want to say two or three things to focus our attention on this. Number one, with respect to the specific language itself, you'll notice that we are using the phrase did or did not have a specific intent or purpose, which is an element of the crime. Now, we just before the meeting started, Courtney and Don and I have been discussing aspects of culpability and dealing with the various words such as intent and purpose and recklessness that become essential elements of any crime. And if, with the reservation, by using specific intent or purpose, this may not be the phrase that ultimately is the choice of the commission by general definition from Article 2, which would be the culpability problems. It is a, the language is designed primarily to indicate that only in the case where a specific intent is involved will the partial responsibility doctrine apply. Now, the California law, evolving from the Wells-Gorsham doctrine, is quite broad and maybe is even broader than the language chosen here. Goldstein, for instance, suggests that the language in the, as a result of the rule in California and as reflected in the Model Penal Code, might even be extend to any element of the crime. And it may be broader than the Model Penal Code itself really intended. There is no discussion at all in the comment to the Model Penal Code section with respect to the kind of, whether they mean specific intent crimes such as burglary or premeditation, or whether they really mean that the evidence of the mental life of the defendant goes to a somewhat broader concept of culpability. I personally think that if we can narrow this down by focusing our purpose to make this specific intent element and limit it to those kind of crimes, this is beneficial. You may not agree with me, of course. Now, secondly, there are a couple of items that ought to be considered in the back of our minds as we're dealing with the substantive provision here, and that is number one, if the partial defense is going, the partial responsibility doctrine is going to be adopted in Oregon, and as I say here in the comment, we're not sure that it actually is in effect by case law. It may be or may not be. But at any rate, if it's going to be the law in Oregon, should the defense be required to give notice before the trial, much as the provision now in the ORS with respect to raising the insanity defense? That's something you'll want to consider. Shall a defense be required to give notice of this particular defense to the state? And secondly, another question that I think is very important here, if a defendant succeeds in the partial responsibility defense, in other words, he proves that because of his mental condition, his mental life or disease or defect, he was unable to premeditate, thereby successfully reducing from first-degree murder to second-degree murder the crime for which he can be convicted, ought the state or ought the court have the same discretionary power to commit this particular defendant for institutionalization because of the obvious mental defect or illness which is less than reduction in this particular defense?
Any discussion on this point?
Yes. One thing I would one reaction I be that a court might not necessarily be so sure that that the reduction from first to second was produced by mental defect. The jury may well have concluded on another basis merely because he brought in evidence tending to show mental defect. Doesn't necessarily mean the jury bought it. That's the genius of the system in a way that it doesn't have to articulate its reasons. Mm-hmm. And while I don't want to close the door on the notion that maybe in some types of situations the sentencing authority ought to have an alternative to prison, I'm not at all sure that it wise just to say that in this type of case, give it, because that doesn't fall. Secondly, I would make that comment. Secondly, I would ask this question. The model code says state of mind. Is there a difference between the word specific intent or purpose and the word state of mind?
Well, I have a feeling. Somebody else want to respond to that?
I'd be glad to whack at it and make an opinion on turn. I think so. California equates it with malice, for instance. Malice can certainly be something other than purpose. Malice is something that I hope we will get away from as we go ahead, but state of mind can be something other than in addition to specific intent or purpose, it seems to me.
Well, what I'm worrying about, though, when we talk about the not having a specific intent, in trying to think over in my mind the possible crime that this would apply to, except for a reduction from first to possibly second or manslaughter, and maybe from assault with intent to kill to pointing a firearm at another, which requires no intent. In any other situation that I can think of, this is going to be not just a reduction, it's going to be a complete defense.
Larceny,
burglary, all these aren't serving to reduce anything. They're serving as a complete defense, and the same as insanity. So that in those type of cases, it should be, at least it seems to me, to be whatever the test of insanity is. It seems like the only justification for the partial responsibility thing is that where in a first degree murder there's got to be the premeditation and the deliberation, and maybe a person is not legally insane, so that they do know what they're doing and know that it's wrong, this type of thing, but because of their mental condition they aren't, supposedly aren't able to go through this deliberation process, and it would be my feeling at least that this partial responsibility, if we're going to have it, should be limited solely as a possible reduction from first to second degree murder, and should be fairly limited to that.
Of course, in a larceny case right now, one of the elements is that the actor, the defendant, intended permanently to deprive the owner of the property. I'm not aware that there would be any prohibition right now in the present state of the law from introduction of evidence, which the defendant feels tends to show that because of his mental condition, he couldn't have intended permanently to deprive Fred of his forbear. I would think that evidence would be admissible. Believed by the jury, presumably would be enough to acquit him. Normally, in those cases, you don't instruct unless they're included, unless there's a question of value or something.
But when you have to give notice,
that's very interesting.
Have to be to the extent that it would go to the extent of the McNaughton rule.
There's a couple of distinctions here, I think, Frank. In the McNaughton defense, or the defense of insanity, the way I think courts have tended to look at it, universally almost, is that it is a so-called sort of pure defense, somewhat like statute of limitations would be. That is, it's a defense that does not go to an element of the crime. But if it does go to an element of the crime, then it's unconstitutional in some places where we have, for instance, the burden of proof allocation on the defendant. But at any rate, that's one of the things that I think there is a distinction here, because the defense of partial responsibility goes directly to an element of the crime the state must prove, and that is specific intent or premeditation, whichever kind of particular mental state is required in the statutory offense. Therefore, I don't think that the McNaughton rule would work here. It puts the jury in the position of an either-or situation. Either we find him insane so that we can acquit him, or we find him guilty of the charge, larceny or murder one, whatever it happens to be. And that brings me to the second point, which gets us back in the circle, in a sense, to my first question, and Judge Burns raises the point, well, how do we know what the jury really found? What do we know the effect on the jury was? Did the jury find him guilty of murder in the second degree because of his mental illness? And we don't know that. That's true. We can't say unless we require that they say it as part of their verdict. But at any rate, it's possible here, we've seen, for a complete acquittal, because there may not be a lesser offense. Or the jury may simply take the law into its own hands, as juries may, and decide that this fellow shouldn't be held guilty of anything. He's charged with murder one, and his defense on the grounds of mental disease or defect is so effective with the jury that they say he shouldn't be held guilty of murder two either, or manslaughter, therefore not guilty. Now, this brings us back to the first question. Ought we not have in the statute, within the discretion of the court, a submission of that particular person to an institution, even after he's been found not guilty of any crime by the jury, where the defendant himself has made the issue, or raised the issue of mental defect and disease? Should society be protected in the sense that this man is going to be committed somewhere to see whether he can be dealt with in a manner to protect society and where he's been turned back into it?
Well, but most of these people aren't going to be committed.
They're not.
If we say they are.
Yeah. Well, but that's you set up a prison for those who are convicted of crimes. You set up a prison for those who are released because they can't form intent, and have a state hospital for those who are insane.
I just had lunch with two of our circuit judges, and district judge and district attorney. We were discussing this point. I have to say that they feel pretty much there should be some mandatory commitment in that situation. We have two well-known cases in Clackamas County now where we wish this could apply.
That's what I did get. By that I mean, partially answering my question, but only partially. In the case of the ability to think, that is the ability to premeditate, you do have a conviction of second degree murder or manslaughter, in which case the judge may nevertheless dispose of it, you know, because he's convicted of a crime. But in the crimes that don't deal with premeditation, they deal with ability to form specific intent, that is, intent. Or not necessarily even the ability to, but whether he did or not. A burglary requires intent to steal, and the fellow goes in and generally the defense is you're looking for a place to stay that night. But as I look back on cases generally where a doctor is following him or something, his testimony is just a matter of being that the fellow was drunk and therefore couldn't really think about what he was doing. He didn't know what he was doing. And generally, no more complicated than that. I can't think of anything which really deals in psychiatric terms beyond that. I can't think of defenses where a person who was dangerous was let go. When I say dangerous, I mean, since somebody other than, let's say, a drunk, an alcoholic. In other words, I can't think of committable people we think of as being committable, being released on this offense. And somehow, to me, it doesn't equate with anything like McNaughton when we talk about general intent. I like the draft. It seems workable.
Of course, we
mean specific and general intent.
I can't speak practically how often this defense is raised. Judge, has it been raised in your court? You know of
no? Well, interestingly enough, yesterday I chatted with Judge Burke, who had a case involving it's a check case, I think. Did you hear it? Did you have your call? It was a check case or a petty larceny case. No, I guess it was a shoplifting case. That's what it was. The guy had taken two tape recorders and something else out of a Big C store. And I hope he made his decision. Otherwise, we'd be telling tales about school. But the fellow had a long history of problems. His son committed suicide. He's so sold his business, and then all kinds of things happened to him. In any event, he produced evidence of that due to his alcoholic state, that he didn't know what he was doing, and therefore didn't have the specific intent to steal. And again, I hope he did it, because he told me on the way back from lunch he was going to quit it on the ground of insanity. But he clearly was not going to commit him thereafter. Now, this happened to be a case where you find it raised in a non-homicide situation. Mm-hmm. Almost never, however, have I seen it raised except in those cases. Arson, you will see it rather frequently in arson. Occasionally in assault with intent to kill. But other than that, almost never.
No, it's not so much of a problem where you've got the offender who chooses or has a predilection for crimes against property. I'm generalizing here, and Doctor, you can certainly correct me, but my general impression of reading on this subject of dangerousness is that these kind of individuals are not going to be particularly dangerous to society, and therefore they're not the kind that ought to be kept in an institution. If there's more reason for putting them out for therapeutic reasons, putting them back into society, I suppose supervising them as outpatients or whatever it is. But the shoplifter just is not quite the same problem that you're going to have with a violent crime against a person.
What you do have is, I mentioned last time,
a fatal problem, that if a guy can't form any intent and he's found out guilty in that, he has an okay then to go ahead and, if he feels like stealing, steal. He's been told it's all right for him to steal.
Of course, it only works where you've got a specific intent crime. We all understand that. There are some places where the general intent is all that's needed, and if the alcoholic defense isn't going to stand up, unless the jury buys it, of course, they can find for the defendant.
Of course, to the extent that Dr. Haugen is correct in his suggestion that when you use the term mental disease or defect, you may well open it up to the alcoholic defense if that ever progresses that far. This might be a problem someday. In other words, take, for example, your shoplifting or some of your typical petty offenses engaged in by alcoholics. Theft of a credit card or use of a credit card, and that sort of thing, which is rather widespread in the Skid Row area in Burnside. Conceivably, you may get to the point where you will have expert testimony that says, yes, alcoholism is a mental disease, therefore, in my opinion, he could not have formed the intent, and so on, and maybe you'll get acquittals, too.
Well,
that
probably
would
be
true
under
McNaughton
rule,
wouldn't
it?
Might be.
If in fact,
there are
being insane as far as other than the not rule or the model being anything out of the era. And this partial responsibility thing, at least as far as the person goes, if he can't deliberate, premeditate, what's the difference? I mean, is there a difference, really, or is it just a defense that's thrown in so that a jury can, if they want to, reduce it down, although they don't want to find him insane, that they can, because of this testimony, find him guilty of something less, in a
Well, I don't know that I can answer your question, because I'm not sure I understand the partial responsibility idea.
Yeah,
it seems to me to relate to what we talked about last time I was here, that if you interpret very, very literally, you box yourself into a sort of a scientifically impossible position. It doesn't make much sense, but if you interpret the thing more broadly, there wouldn't be much difference as far as I can see.
Anything that would reduce responsibility, this partial responsibility, really should be enough to find an ideal reason.
Well, from the point of view of a behavioral scientist, a psychiatrist, psychologist, that sort of thing, I think in anything anybody does, the amount of responsibility varies from zero to
responsible as people can be, and you would have to analyze each act in terms of that person's total life history and the circumstances at the time, and you would come up with a subjective evaluated place on a scale that goes from zero to complete. Even in our sickest patients, we consider that they have some responsibility for many things that they do.
But is there a point where you can say, I mean, using not the strict interpretation of McNaughton, but the more broad one we discussed last night, that is there a point where a person may not come within this ruling? I mean, come within this area of being not responsible for his act, and yet be at a degree where he couldn't form a specific intent to commit, I mean, to steal or permanently deprive, say? I mean, if he's mentally ill to the point that he cannot form an intent to permanently deprive, hasn't he reached a point where he doesn't know the difference between right and wrong or the nature and consequences of his act? Or what is the...
It would seem to me, I would think yes. I can't think of any instance where a person would be so impaired that he couldn't form intent and at the same time be able to tell right from wrong. It seems to me that my understanding has always been that the right from wrong test means that he is able to form intent.
I'm just sitting here not being very helpful, but I was wondering if that's correct. The law seems to be pretty clear that intoxication, while not a defense to crime, can be sufficient to prevent one from having specific intent and prevent one from having a special mental element such as a knowledge. But the law is clear on that.
Yeah, because he's non-competent at the time that he is unable to inform intent. And so if it weren't for the drinking, which he has an intoxication defense, if he were not drunk and in that condition, and in the same mental state, he would be legally insane. But he's not legally insane in the intoxication defense because he's drunk.
Thinking out loud for a minute, and I'm certainly not taking issue with you. We had the experience in California for a number of years now under the Wells abortion doctrine, where psychiatrists do testify that there can be partial responsibility in this successful defense in California and elsewhere. Now, so at least there's probably a division of opinion in psychiatry, but let's, for a moment, focus on the community interest in this thing. Look at it not as a scientific problem, but as a community, societal problem. After all, McNaughton is a legal test. Sometimes it's confused with being a medical test, but it's clearly a legal test, and that's why psychiatrists have difficulty testifying under it sometimes, because they have to testify in medical terms to what is essentially not a medical defense. All right, the defense is designed for the illumination of the juror. That's really what it's for, the trier of the fact. Now, if we give the jury a situation and testimony by a psychiatric expert that the defendant doesn't know right from wrong, or extensive mental life evidence, and we have a McNaughton rule only, the jury has one of two choices. It can acquit him, not guilty, by reason of insanity, or it must find him guilty. Either way, the defendant is not subjected to the penal institution. There's no conviction as far as sending him to prison goes, at least not in our state. We don't have a community or a joint effort of institutionalizing this defendant. But looking at it again from the standpoint of the jury, if in fact they can get an instruction from the court that the defendant may still be guilty of a crime based on the testimony they hear, but still not guilty of the ultimate of the crime charge. In other words, it's giving the jury a place to go to express community feelings about insanity, about mental illness, and yet serving the functions of the criminal law of deterrence, rehabilitation, retribution certainly is a big aspect of this. It is inserting somewhere in the trial the possibility that the jury can play on that 0 to 100% scale, as I understood you'd say, with respect to responsibility. If they think this particular defendant, based on a rather general legal instruction, shouldn't be convicted of murder in the first degree because we just don't feel like he should be committed for life or sentenced to life, and yet we don't feel that he should be discharged completely as the result would be under not guilty by reason of insanity. Therefore, we can find an interim ground or a ground of compromise, whatever you want to call it, where the community feelings and the purposes of the criminal law can be served by finding this man guilty of a lesser offense. I suppose we're talking in terms of philosophy, then.
Well, my reaction to that is I think maybe it's going in the wrong direction because you're sort of begging the question as to whether he was responsible and should be punished or not. And I wonder if what society doesn't want is some protection from him repeating this sort of behavior. So that the question of whether or not he was guilty is similar to whether or not a person is mentally ill. He's not guilty of being mentally ill, he's just mentally ill, and that's too bad, and we don't want to be bothered with him as a menace or a threat or even a severe nuisance. So therefore, he is sent here until he ceases to be a threat or a nuisance or a problem.
If all this assumes that a jury actually goes through such stratified reflection in making the decision. I'm not sure that they actually do that. I'm not even talking about jurors. I'm not at all sure judges do that. How do you separate them in point of fact? You're not talking about a case where the question is, was it this guy or Fred down the street that pulled the trigger? You're talking about a case, this guy pulled the trigger, now what are you gonna, what kind of result are you gonna achieve and so on? I'm not at all sure that a human being is capable of separating what formal tag do we hang on him, and then next, what consequences flow from that, namely OSP or OSH or whatever.
Well, it certainly has a different impact on society based on what's been said here in our subcommittee meeting last time. If in fact the defendant is successful in the insanity defense and is found not guilty by reason of insanity and is committed for institutionalization in the mental hospital, we found, or at least the feeling is, that he doesn't spend very much time there, that he's returned to society very soon. That means to a jury, if they know this, and of course they can't be told that. We have a case here in Oregon that says you may not tell a jury what will happen to the defendant if you find him not guilty by reason of insanity. But we'll assume that somebody on the jury knows that he can be put away.
Our jurors are instructed on it.
There's a case in Oregon that says that's
fine, but the state should have the right to appeal.
Yeah, right.
So this is one of the biggest defense arguments, is if you're not turning guilty because the judge can come into the state.
Can you get that in the instructions from
me? Gotcha.
We'll hear more of this when we get to the part on the question of state right to appeal.
Yes.
Yeah. But you see, I mean, that's the state.
Am I wrong about that case holding?
Oh, no.
Very well could be, but I do remember a case directly in point where the instruction had included the effect of the statute that the judge may, by discretion, in other words, the language of the statute was read to the jury. And of course,
the way to get to the Supreme Court is when the judge gives it over the defense objection, and then maybe
you have to keep in mind he's speaking.
That's how I got there.
One of the things we were talking about in support of Mahatma a couple weeks ago was that the people who are truly sick seem to get to the hospital, and those who aren't don't. In other words, McNaughton worked out pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be scared of committing under a partial responsibility kind mm-hmm. of acquittal, because I don't think it really selects out people who are suitable for a treatment. The drunk who didn't think when he didn't act, for example, doesn't make a particularly valid certification at the state hospitals. These things might get done. So I would hate to see partial the treatment of a partial responsibility situation made analogous to the treatment of an insanity defense, general intent defense. And I think that if we want to make, nevertheless have some hold on the fellow, then perhaps it should be in the definitions of the crimes, so that the crime, perhaps without the specific intent, remains a lesser included. For example, breaking and entering is not really prohibited now, and it is variously by a little bit differently by a trespass statute, but breaking and entering isn't. Burglary is breaking and entering plus specific intent to commit a crime therein. The fellow says he didn't want to commit a crime, he's acquitted. It seems to me that breaking and entering ought really to be a lesser crime as well. If there is a diminished responsibility, acquittal of the greater, hold him on the lesser. And I think that's true. Just about every specific intent crime I can think of, we have taking and using a motor vehicle as basically a larceny without specific intent, but we don't have taking and using a typewriter, or a television set.
Well, aren't we solving some of these problems in the theft statutes? Yes. Yes. Actually, we have some included offenses.
What other specific intent crimes are there? Those are the ones that come specifically to mind. Judge Burns mentioned arson, because I recall with arson, that's a general.
I believe it is.
But it seems to me like just about every time you mention it, there is an appropriate lesser included to draft, which doesn't require specific intent
origin to
protect society against that particular danger. So,
well, the thing is, I mean, if there isn't some lesser crime, like of course in first degree murder, it's an attempt to they don't have enough, you know, to have the defense of insanity, so they use this to reduce the crime. But, like, let's take, in, for instance, larceny of a typewriter, $175. Even though the person is clearly insane, the defense attorney would not want to file a notice of intent to prove insanity. All he wants to do is just bring in all his evidence simply to show that he could perform the intent. Amount to an acquittal, the same as if he were insane, so you don't.
Well, I remember I made the comment at our last meeting that one of the competitors with the insanity defense is the partial responsibility doctrine for this very reason. The defendant may choose, happily, to take his chances with partial responsibility and therefore is inclined or steered away from the insanity defense. This is one of the areas where.
Well,
competition
sure,
is reducing the effect of the overall insanity defense, and I think this is one of the things that perhaps can be critically said, I don't know how validly, but critically said about partial responsibility.
Don, you had
well, I wanted to make this observation. It seems to me that one thing that can be said in support of this draft, and I'm not implying that there can only be one thing said in support of it, but one thing I think we should keep in mind is that I think we all recognize that there are lesser included offenses, and that the jurors are called upon to make value judgments in reaching a verdict as certainly in most cases on the question of intent or on the question of premeditation and deliberation. And it seems to me that a rule that would allow the jury to have the benefit of as much evidence and testimony on the issues of either intent or on the issues of premeditation and deliberation, as much evidence as possible, including expert testimony, psychiatrists, medical testimony, that would go to these very issues of premeditation and deliberation, that we are going to be assisting the jury, it seems to me, in discharging its responsibilities.
Take again the case that we talked about last time, that troublesome case of the woman who had killed her three children, Von Kleek, I think her name was. And the charge was murder in the first degree, and all the testimony of experts to the effect, they all agreed she was mentally ill, clearly. They couldn't agree she was insane, and the jury found that she was not insane, but found second degree murder. Now, in the opinion, it's impossible to tell. Here, Judge, I think you made this point. It's impossible to tell whether the state actually proved, whether the defense actually proved lack of premeditation for reasons other than mental illness, or whether in fact it was the mental illness. But I get the feeling, and here's strictly my own feeling, that that jury found second degree murder because of the testimony of the woman's mental life. Now, if that's so, and that's a big supposition on my point, it takes us to the next. The jury has been given an opportunity to find this woman guilty of a crime that they think is a heinous offense, to express community's feelings about this, and we've got to cope with that, I think, and keep that in mind. And yet, if we could then commit this woman to institutionalization, she would not be faced with a 25-year life sentence, or 25-year sentence. It may be quite unnecessary, and here again, I can't speak as a psychiatrist, it may be quite unnecessary to keep that woman the minimal 7 years before her parole would be considered. It might be possible to return her to society within 6 months or a year. Maybe the treatment, not only is the jury enabled to have greater breadth of discretion in its own feelings, but the actual offender himself, given a commitment proceeding of some sort, would be better off than society would. If the woman, in fact, ought to be held more than 7 years, then the psychiatrists who have her in their grips, as it were, ought to be able to make that decision. The parole board is going to have to make the decision later at 7 years, whether to parole her or not. And this is a situation, perhaps, where the psychiatrist in the mental hospital would be better suited to make that decision. You know, this is all suppositions on my part, but some of the considerations, I think, that are involved.
I think another point, now it's my understanding that in California, they're trying to plug a hole here with respect to partial responsibility defense in that standpoint of notice of utilization of this defense. They don't have to give notice now, is that correct?
Well,
or is there
I'm
some
sure
question on
the
it?
Law,
at least
they
feel that
question.
There's probably some question on
yeah.
it, whether or not the prosecution is entitled to advance notice that the defense is going to rely upon this partial and that by codifying this partial responsibility rule, they will require the same notice to be given of intent to use this as a defense as they do under total insanity.
You know, I don't think the prosecution is interested in knowing ahead of time that defense of partial responsibility is going to be used, as it is knowing ahead of time that expert testimony is going to be used. You know what I mean? You can have a partial responsibility case involving a fellow who just testifies on his own behalf. I didn't know what I was doing. I was drunk. Wandered in there.
Yeah.
But really,
there's
you're talking about exposing the jury, you know, to greater exposition of the facts. If there's notice of intent, I don't think it's particularly necessary to do it in all diminished responsibility cases. I think it is important to do it wherever there is psychiatric or medical or expert testimony on the subject.
Sure, what's so wrong with just saying that either side in a criminal case is going to call an expert, such as those, and they've got to give notice? It seems to me it solved the problem that you mentioned of using this as a substitute for the insanity defense, because this way they don't have to tip off the other side that they've got Hank Dixon in the wings. Really, because there's no reason in the world why, unless you just think a lot of this party theory of justice, no reason in the world why you shouldn't have to tell the other guy that, hey, I'm going to call a psychiatrist or whatever. If you're really looking for the truth.
Well, of course, what we're doing now is we're flirting, we're hip deep in procedural matters here, and these matters are in great contest among prosecution and defense-minded lawyers now, what to do with notice and alibis and other things. I don't think we should avoid it. I think that cases like this where procedure is so intertwined with substantive provision, and we've got to face the problem. In answer to your question, Don, or someone anyhow, California did not require, there was no notice requirement under Wells-Gorsham.
No.
Prior to this would be a new provision. Notice is required. And I'd also add, this material that appears in your books, I wish it could have been made available to you before this meeting, but I didn't get it from California until 2 days ago. and it's very good and deals with many of these procedural problems which we must, I think, confront and dispose of here in Oregon. And the notice provision is one of them. The psychiatric examination reports, all sorts of matters relating to both the insanity defense and partial responsibility. And I'd like to point out that California does, in its proposed draft, not its present law, does propose a commitment, a discretionary commitment proceedings where mental illness or mental life of the defendant has been in contention at the trial, whether it be insanity or partial responsibility.
I'm just glad that partially just for examination and evaluation, or is it actually for it?
Well, that's true also, but I'm talking about now the disposition of the offender after he's been found guilty of murder in the second degree, and the evidence has been such to show mental illness. Then California will provide, if this draft is adopted, and I don't know about that, but it would then provide that the judge might, within his discretion, in appropriate cases, commit that person to mental authorities rather than the penal authorities, mental health division. By the way, as an aside, this provision on responsibility presented by California does end the split trial system. It does not wish to continue the split trial.
Senator Terry, you have any comments?
No, the only observation that I would make, I don't see how you're going to, at this stage, how you're going to segregate or separate out the procedural aspects of this from the substantive. Because they're so interrelated that it seems to me that you simply won't be doing the job if you say this is procedural, so we're going to overlook it, because you can't make a decision on the other without that, in my judgment. Burden of proof, for example, is in that area. But what's wrong with taking both of them?
Well, I think they must be in certain isolated instances, and I think the responsibility is certainly one of the places. I really think the procedural disposition of these people is more important than the rule we actually adopt, whether it be McNaughton or ALI or Durham or any of the rest of them. I'm not so concerned about the substantive provision as I am the procedural matters for the proof, which we settled, by the way, last time, Senator.
Oh.
Yeah, we decided that's where it was. And all these other matters. Highly important, these issues that are raised in this California draft. Calling of experts in the pretrial examination, the kind of report that must be given, or the kind of report that the psychiatrist is directed to make. This is something that the law, by and large, has ignored. In many instances, psychiatrists haven't just frankly known how to respond to the court's requirement. The court hasn't really known, in many cases, what to ask for. Well, these drafts of California, and I think they reflect the awareness of these problems elsewhere, would fill in some of the voids that have heretofore existed with respect to the insanity defense or mental illness. At any rate, what I propose, since we started talking about this California material, I found that the drafts and the explanation with each section was so efficiently and neatly done and very well done that there would be no point in extensive drafting by the staff now, and that it ought to be on the next, if we don't deal with any of these matters now, it certainly ought to be for your study between now and the next meeting on the basis of what is here. The only thing we need to know is what the present status of the Oregon law is with respect to any given provision, and that's relatively easy for us to determine. Policy issues are certainly discussed briefly, but I think they do point up what the issues really are, and the answer is forthcoming.
Any other comments in this section? Too much new in this material, particularly on section 1 or 2.
Yes.
In this California?
Yes, quite a bit.
Yeah, it deals universally with the entire problem of responsibility in one place, and we're still in the kind of piecemeal situation where we're taking the sections as they get to our attention. I think I kind of feel like apologizing for that, too. I haven't really presented to this commission, this subcommittee, a logical, complete draft of what I think ought to be contained in a responsibility article, and I suppose I can plead partial responsibility and not guilty because of the peculiar volunteer nature of which Courtney and I both are operating, that is, we have time commitments elsewhere. And in a sense, I feel bad about that, not being able to give you all in one place at one time the overall picture. So as I've gone along, what I'm trying to do at least is suggest to you what questions ought to be answered at least in connection with the specific problem before us.
When Governor Hatfield, I believe it was, vetoed the legislative enactment of the ALI. One of the reasons, I recall, was that we didn't have adequate facilities to take care of all of these. What would happen if at this stage we now were to say that in any case where the sanity of the defendant was involved, regardless of whether the verdict was one of guilty or not guilty, how would that fit into our, wouldn't we be facing the same problem he mentioned in his veto message? Would we have the necessary facilities to take care of all of these people? How much of a burden would it place upon the state? How many instances would there be when defendants who presently are not sent to any mental authorities or state authorities, what would be the impact? Should we consider that or not?
Of course, I have no criticism of Governor Hatfield. I'm not at all sure that Governor Hatfield had a sufficient factual basis upon which to make that assertion, namely that he's going to fill out the mental hospital if you adopt the ALI rule. I have tried to scout around in the 2 weeks since our last meeting and have been unsuccessful in any way even to go about finding out how many instances in which there have been insanity questions raised in criminal cases in Multnomah County. I know a way to do it, but I don't begin to have the manpower to do it. I could go through all of the trial dockets.
Well, Jim, Cole has been the legal advisor. He served on the circuit bench for some time, and I believe he was defeated here in Marion County.
Lauren Hicks,
I believe, did go into that matter of statistics and provided the governor with information on the basis of which he made that statement. So perhaps that information is available.
Maybe.
I know he did that.
Maybe.
You know, I don't think the problem is exactly the same either. I have a feeling, here again, without being able to prove it, that adopting the ALI substantive rule is not going to fill up the mental prison. I don't think that's not. There are not going to be that many more successful defendants under it. But we might have more of a problem if we have partial responsibility, because these people were not headed toward mental institutions under any circumstances. So this may have the real impact, I think, will be here instead of under whatever rule we choose. And I would include Durham. I don't think that Durham would make a great influx into the mental institutions.
When we talk about practicality, from my point of view, the thing that concerns me is that a prison is set up and thought of as some place that you send somebody for punishment. And if they're not guilty and you're not going to punish them, you can't send them there. And I don't think this really makes sense in this day and age, because prisons have rehabilitation programs. And I would like to see you gentlemen write the laws or the laws developed in such a way that you can use the institution for the people in the way that best meets their needs, irregardless of what legal rigmarole you went through to get them there. And that's more concern to me. Now, it's fine if you make a mistake and send somebody to prison, well, that's all right, because we can move more to the hospital. But we get them at the hospital, and they don't fit into our program there, and they wouldn't fit into a prison program, we can't get them there. So it's a one-way battle. That's where the problem is, as far as I'm concerned.
I recognize that, and I would certainly think that if partial responsibility is adopted with a commitment, that there ought to be an interchange provision the other way, away from the mental institution back to the prison, and that would be the greatest flexibility built in as possible.
What kind of a sentence would that be?
Yeah.
Ooh, and then you get
process problems and everything else.
Yeah.
Penitentiary without having been
convicted. Well, he's convicted.
No, really not.
This assumes that he's convicted of something.
It's like
the judge has the discretion to either commit or confine to the penal institution. Then you could have either institution transferred without due process. I'm not aware that anybody knows how many more persons will be acquitted by reason of insanity with the ALI rule than not. I don't know how you go about getting figures like that, really.
I have run across just yesterday this very interesting article written by a psychologist and a law professor. I think they were both at Chicago, I'm not sure. At least they were teaching at the same university and had gone together to write an article on the insanity defense. And it sets out, as I recall, 10 or 12 specific cases, very briefly describing the mental disease, the facts that were presented at the trial, the assumed psychiatric testimony, and the author's guess is really what it is, as to the disposition of the offender under McNaughton and under ALI and under Durham. In other words, a comparison on one fact situation. Now, the conclusion of those authors was that there would be more people found not guilty by reason of insanity under any rule but McNaughton. And I guess we'd have to conclude, if they're right, that the mental hospitals under any rule would get more people from the insanity defense so long as it wasn't McNaughton. They found that the McNaughton rule produced the fewest successful defendants in that case. And I'd be happy to find that citation if anybody wants to read it.
We do know from D.C. that under Durham, St. Elizabeth's Hospital was just plain overcrowded with people more sick. So mental fail.
Incidentally, I might mention on this question of filling the state hospitals. Also in your books there's some material copies that we made of minutes that were taken in the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1961, testimony with respect to Senate Bill 96, which was the bill that incorporated the ALI test. And on page 4 of those minutes, there's testimony from Dr. Conklin, and he doesn't give any figures, although his testimony generally was there would be a great increase not only in the number of insanity, but in his opinion, but also he said that we were if the public is to be protected, we were going to have to furnish some larger facilities for the care of this increased number of individuals who would not be sent to the penitentiary if Senate Bill 96 were passed. That might be of interest to you. We also have, for the benefit of the subcommittee, Xerox copies of minutes taken by the Legislative Interim Committee on Criminal Law in 1959 and 1960 on this same question. Those are available. They're not your books, but we have them available for the use of the subcommittee.
Do you have any copies there?
No.
I'd like to get one for you.
Any other comments? Shall we move on to the second?
Since we had directions from the subcommittee last time about this, I'm somewhat worried that I carried out your instructions in the manner in which you wanted the disposition here. Now, I'll tell you what my intent was, and it might have been misconstrued. I might have misconstrued your directions at the outset. My intent was that the present juvenile code of Oregon would be completely untouched by this provision. There'd be no effect on it at all. There would be no effect on the little rule under this draft. This draft is aimed only at dealing with those offenders, and it would be a very small group, obviously, who for some reason have escaped or have not been taken into the juvenile code disposition of their case for a criminal act committed at an age less than 14. That is, by the draft here, that is the common law cutoff point at which time we don't have any presumptions anymore of irresponsibility. And this draft incorporates the pure common law rule to the effect that a person under 7 cannot be held responsible for any criminal act or any act. Between the ages of 7 and not over 14, he is presumed to be irresponsible, that is, he's presumed innocent of this kind of an act, but it's a rebuttable presumption which usually becomes weaker as he approaches age 14. And of course, over age 14, complete responsibility for one's act.
I'm wondering what kind of instruction you'd give about that becoming weaker.
Well, I don't think...
How would you deal with that practice?
I don't think you would.
Deal with that in final argument.
Yeah, I don't think you would. That's the way
the same thing as your 1.5 and 1.5.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a turn, but speaking for myself only, I'm a foreigner. I'm going back in the dark. It seems to me that Illinois, before they adopted the rule, would have a cutoff point of 12. Below 12, you don't even think about the situation. But this looks pretty horrendous to me. I may not have any argumentative influence at all. It seems to me that we ought to just analyze the statutes of all the 50 states and see what people do. I'm sure that you wouldn't find any of them go this far back. I'm not criticizing George because he's reflecting what he thought was the sense.
No, I don't. I'll correct that. I don't think the subcommittee wanted years to draft along this line to chew on. And I don't have any of this, and I don't think the subcommittee does, but we are now faced with choosing the cutoff point.
I think the presumption thing gets an awful iffy thing in that hardly is to make a judgment would require. I would hate to have an AG below 14, or firm at whatever age you want.
You just want to raise the 7 to a higher number.
Yeah.
Well, as I pointed out in some of the new codes, it's 15. Age 15 in New York, isn't it? They aren't trying to deal with the problem that this subcommittee is interested in dealing with.
As if, like, the practical matter we're talking about simply, murder is going to be the only possible situation where under the statute of limitations or anything else that we're ever going to get into this question, unless they revise the juvenile code and move the ages down where there's a possible remand.
You can toll the statute by absence of a state case.
Is there, I don't know what the statute is there a 6-year on felon, sub-felon?
Three on felons, two on misdemeanors, but no statute in the code.
Is rape included in the 3-year? I know some places it's not. Mm-hmm.
But it's entirely possible that kids don't stay 14 or 15 or whatever statute would be.
What's the general feeling about the age you hear Professor Archer's comment? You think it's not too important a point, and you have no objection, I think, to raise it for you.
Well, the only thing there, I do have one thing that bothers me about this, and putting presumptions on this type of thing, is that I think in light of the adult case, the other part of the being able to, whether a 12-year-old who has down the house can even be made a ward of the court. Because unless it can be shown, I mean, you get this, especially if you raise it to the age of 14, presume that they're not responsible. You've got a real serious question. I mean, as long as you're between the 7 and 14, bracket, I suppose, under this, I mean, at least you've got an argument that you can file a petition and have it found within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court. But if you raise the presumption of non-responsibility up to 14, you're going to have a problem in juvenile cases. Whether or not they can even be brought within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court when.
Why should that fall from putting this in here? Then don't we make it clear that we're not attempting to tamper with juvenile court jurisdiction?
Well, that's certainly the intent. Well, notice from the first sentence, the person who is trying to report for criminal jurisdiction, this is clearly outside the juvenile code.
Until the Supreme Court tells us differently, it's still not a criminal proceeding, juvenile court.
Mm-hmm. It's a serious civil wrong, if nothing else, isn't it? It's a kind of a delinquent act. You can at least do it as a
kid commits repeated arsons or burglaries, you could always allege that they were beyond the control of their parents.
The frankest thing would be that they may go is indicating whatever we call it, it's still a criminal offense, aren't you?
Well, that you're dealing with doing away with the juvenile.
That doesn't mean that a juvenile is criminally responsible. Simply because of the Gault decision. And this language here.
Sure.
But we're going to start coming. The next decision is going to be that juveniles are entitled to a jury trial.
Maybe.
And I've got three cases pending.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is. It's got to follow.
What would the issue be on, even if a jury trial is permitted? Wouldn't the issue wouldn't be on whether it's a criminal act or not.
Well, you're going to have to prove that they, you know, it's going to be the same. You're going to have to prove that they committed a crime.
Mm-hmm.
If they were in a, but we don't call it a crime when we're talking about juvenile.
We're not attempting in juvenile court, even if we have a jury, to litigate the issue of criminal responsibility. Merely because Supreme Court says you've got to have a lawyer and maybe a jury and maybe prove beyond a reasonable doubt. You're still not litigating the issue of criminal responsibility. You're litigating the issue of did he do an act which, if an adult, would be a crime, and did he do these other things?
But if he is incapable.
This is criminally responsible.
But I would assume that you would be able to have an insanity defense for a juvenile as well as an adult. I mean, let's assume, I mean, that you do have a situation where a juvenile is insane, he wouldn't be found in the jurisdiction of juvenile court because he would not have committed an act which would have been a crime if he was a child.
What you're trying to get is some kid under 16, under 16, that does something when he's under 16 and somehow you don't latch on to him until he's over 18. This is what you're talking about. What do you do with him?
It's a very serious question, I think. He certainly is entitled to some kind of defense based on immaturity, and I think that's the question. How far down do we want to go in years before we say that that particular person is no longer or is below a certain age is not responsible for his crime. And what year appeals to you, Courtney? Do you have any strong feelings on that?
I would be 15, but
well, that seems to be the age now being adopted throughout the country. I mean, at least it seems to be a tendency to raise it, and that far.
Isn't it only deep in the presumption?
No, he's absolutely incapable of crime. No presumption at all. Or he's got, unless you want to call it.
I would say no. I think my 6-year-old girl state something that belongs to somebody else.
Yeah, but still, you're not going to court. You're not going to have the case of State versus Susie Knight.
What you're really talking about is how long a DA can sit on a case before he indicts.
Well, no, we're not. This may be the age itself, but this is not what we're.
If at the age of 15, all you're doing is saying the little case is restricted to 1 year's waiting. Which frankly seems quite reasonable. I think Frank is correct that it's really going to apply on a murder case in this report.
Well, it's undoubtedly a very small number.
I
hey, if you adopt
your person, they're so immature that they cannot commit a crime. I think they are mature. I think they do know.
When I was in law school, a kid in Chicago, out in Forest Park, as I recall, I'm pretty sure it was 9 years of age, he killed a little kid, 7, repeatedly dropping concrete blocks on the little kid's head after he knocked it down. Well, that's a terrible thing, and I suppose in one sense of what the kid knew he was doing, but I wouldn't think any civilized society would thereupon say, okay, it'll be criminal court for you. However, and you wouldn't say that to a 10-year-old, or 11-year-old, or a 12-year-old. Now, from here on, you start getting some some controversy. Maybe a 13-year-old or a 14-year-old, you'd say to them, okay, in your case, why do you run into criminal court?
Well, in one situation, the test of insanity, when we're discussing whether we should have the Naughton rule, the ALI formula, or the Durham rule, we are trying to protect the defendant to a certain extent by determining what his mental capacity was at the time that he did that. And yet here, we're picking an arbitrary date and saying, regardless of the mental ability of that person, he cannot be tried in criminal. It seems to me this is a little inconsistency, unless we're sure to make the age low enough.
Seems to me the higher you raise the age, the more you need to keep the presumption in there. I mean, make it a presumption rather than a flat rule of law. Some of the statistics on crime, juvenile crime, show that, if I'm not mistaken, that some of the FBI statistics, for example, show that the age of children of the age of 15 is the greatest number of offenders fall in the age of 15 for juvenile crimes.
Well, look at car thefts. What if we were to raise this to 18?
That would suggest it, of course, yes.
No, I realize that, but I mean, just as an illustration, the car theft, that situation where we did raise it to 18, or even 17.
Well, we're still only talking about the few cases where you commit a crime under 16, get your hands on until he's above 18. That's the only case we're talking about.
This is strictly limited to that.
Yeah, because if he's...
that's assuming the juvenile court stays away.
Yeah, assuming the juvenile court, he'll be handled through the juvenile court until he's 18. Unless it's the rare case where he's under 16 and you lose him for 2.5 years.
But I took Courtney's suggestion. Well, the effect of his suggestion would be to eliminate sub B and raise the age in A from 7, say, to 15.
Yeah.
Yes, well, that would eliminate some problems, too. There's a problem in that sub B because the language in there looks very much like the insanity defense. That is, that he didn't know the consequences of his conduct or appreciate that the conduct was wrong. Now, it's not the insanity defense, but it's language that's similar to it. And you avoid that problem if you avoid the rebuttable presumption issue.
Well, you might raise A to 10, but I think you gotta have somewhere in there that
I suffer from a language.
In one situation, would you be waiting until an 11-year-old is 16 or 18 to prostitute for a crime? You're
not.
So, I mean, I don't see
that. That's why. And the Supreme Court's on the table, they had some reason to put it in here. So we're talking about when you've got a juvenile charge in juvenile court who's 12 years old.
Would your problem not be solved by sticking in an express disclaimer that this is not to affect juvenile court jurisdiction?
I don't even think it's necessary to put this in at all.
I feel strong about it. I think it was the problem.
I don't, this is trying to get at the little case in a backhand way, but when you've got the speedy trial situation, which it clearly applies to little, I can't, I mean, I suppose you could get the situation where 10-year-old, 9-year-old, the family could move away. And
suppose that the those found to be responsible in the Peyton Allen case turned out to have been 15 at the time, and he didn't have a statute to cover. I imagine that everybody in the state would be right to exercise the criminal law revision committee.
Well, no, if this weren't in there, there'd be no problem. In the Peyton Allen case. Now, if it turns out that they had been 14.
Wouldn't there be a common law challenge in the Peyton Allen case if that were true?
Yeah.
When they say, according to the common law, there's a presumption that these fellows are not competent to perform intent because they're too young?
Yeah, but doesn't under the common law, doesn't go clear back to the statute?
Yeah.
And, I think the common law was very.
So, I think the question is whether to rely on the common law or whether we should. The commission should codify what they wish to be the case. Because I think in the absence of a statute, the common law would control. And this is, as I recall, the common law. Isn't this the same agents involved?
Well, I don't see how any court can later mistake what our purpose is when it's clearly spelled out in the first paragraph of the explanation. We're dealing with two very selective groups of situations here, and that's all. We're not dealing with anything else. And those groups of situations are,
well,
at least one group is extremely rare, and the second group is relatively rare.
I mean, I think this is the only thing that would bother me is if this is applied to juvenile court proceedings, because a person who is under the age of 16 except in the little situation cannot be remanded, so it's impossible for him to be tried in criminal in an adult court, a criminal court, a juvenile court, a criminal court, whether you want to call it that or not. That this is ultimately going to be applied to the juvenile proceedings if it's in there. And that's the only thing that bothers me about having it here at all, is that having this applied to juvenile proceedings, because I don't think, except in the deal where you got a 15-year-old coming close to reaching the age of 16, like little, you're not going to have a little situation. And so it,
includes a person who was tried as an adult in the court of criminal jurisdiction. Solve your problem. That's some sort of disclaimer in the statute. So.
Well, aren't those who are 17 and who are remanded tried as adults?
Yeah.
Specifically that.
Yeah.
We say here a person who's tried as an adult.
A person who's tried as an adult is assumed to be criminal, presumed not to be criminally responsible.
Well, someone will look at that and say, what are those guys doing now?
Yeah, our city is way far out. You see, that's the thing that bothers me about even putting it in.
One thing about it, Frank,
I think we take it really easy, but I would try it in court and better work. So we're very easy to do that. Not to do it in court.
Other than under ORS, whatever it is,
yeah.
Which provides for
doing it, whatever it is.
Whichever it is, provides for doing court.
Taking a